Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. After Anthony Bourdain died in June of 2018, his longtime assistant, editor, and co-author, Lori Wulliver, faced a difficult choice about a project they'd begun together but didn't have a chance to finish, a travel guide. She writes, "It's a hard and lonely thing to co-author a book about the wonders of world travel when your writing partner, that traveler, is no longer traveling the world. And to be honest, in the difficult days and weeks after Tony's death, I once again found myself asking, does this world need this book? What is the answer to this question? And why, even more, does the world need this book?" Wulliver, who worked with Bourdain since 2009, had traveled with him to locations around the globe for his shows, No Reservations and Parts Unknown, she moved forward with the project, which became a book called World Travel, An Irreverent Guide. In addition to being a practical travel guide, it introduces readers to some of Anthony Bourdain's favorite places and features thoughtful essays from his friends, colleagues, and family. Lori Wulliver is also the co-author of Appetites, a cookbook written with Anthony Bourdain and published in 2016. World Travel, An Irreverent Guide is out now. Lori, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
What did you and Tony originally envision for this project?
Well, the blueprint for this book was something that we laid out before Tony died. We had a meeting. I went in with a list of every place that he had ever been in the world, and we went through those places one by one and decided whether or not we thought we could make a good chapter out of those places and what were some of the restaurants, bars, attractions, hotels, markets, different things that we might include in each chapter. And Tony had an astonishing ability to recall the places that he really loved and that really made an impression on him. And he had been to, I think, close to 100 countries, some of them more than once. So this was the plan that we made, and I tried very hard to stick as much as possible to that original blueprint. There were some places that I had to make decisions to add or to cut because places had closed or changed. Of course, COVID changed some things for businesses and for travel. But I really did try and stick with the plan that he laid out, because these were the places that were really important to him and that he had something to say about.
What made you go forward with the project?
Well, the fact that it was an unfinished project, but one that he was so enthusiastic about before he died, something that he really wanted to do and that he had such an exciting kind of vision for. He had intended to write a bunch of essays for the book, and I felt like his heart and soul were in it, and so it just made sense to go forward and to try and finish the work that we had started, and to, you know, share this last sort of collection that of his work, and it becomes kind of a celebration of all of the work that he did traveling for television over almost 20 years. So it just, after, you know, the initial grief period and the sort of shock, it just felt that I almost didn't have a choice. And and as I worked through it, it became a way to sort of process my own grief and to sort of make some peace with what had happened, and to share what ends up being a very positive reflection on Tony's work.
So the places in the book go from, it's from A to V, literally Argentina, Australia,
yeah.
There's Bhutan, Israel, Morocco, Mozambique, goes all the way up to Vietnam. But I'm going to concentrate on New Jersey, because Tony grew up in northern New Jersey, just outside of the city. And as you write, he grew up in a nuclear family that valued arts, culture, education, and good table manners. Just the thing for him to chafe against as a rebellious youth with a taste for the more venal pleasures of New York City, though he always retained a nostalgic soft spot for the Garden State. I'm so curious, what were some of his favorite spots in New Jersey?
his number one favorite spot was a place called Hiram's, which is still very much in business. It's in Fort Lee. It's called Hiram's Road Stand, and it's what they're known for are their hot dogs. It's completely unpretentious, very, very affordable, and it's a place where you can get a deep-fried hot dog called the Ripper that's so cooked so well that it sort of splits open in the deep fryer, so it's kind of crunchy and chewy, really, really delicious. You know, one of his favorite things to do off-camera, although I think he did also visit for television, was to just get in the car and drive over to Fort Lee, get a hot dog, maybe some onion rings and a root beer. And this was a place that he had started visiting with his family when he was a kid. And he continued on into his own family life.
Yeah, there's a great one of these essays from his brother, Christopher Bourdain. It's called Revisiting New Jersey with Tony. What does the essay reveal about his connection to Jersey?
I think that it was a place that he, you know, he never kind of gave in to the easy jokes about New Jersey, you know, that you would hear from stand-up comedians in the 80s and 90s. He really loved it. He saw it for what it was. I think he always aspired, like I said in the book, he aspired to be a New Yorker, but he loved the shore. You know, this was a family ritual for a nuclear family to go to the shore in the summertime. He had a love of Atlantic City, you know, as sort of complicated and strange a place as that is. You know, he loved driving too. You know, sort of late in life, he got a car, and he insisted when he shot an episode in New Jersey, he insisted on driving himself to set, which definitely caused some consternation among the producers, who were very used to kind of shuttling him from place to place. And, you know, this is suddenly the talent is out, you know, on his own on the Garden State Parkway. But it was a place that he always had a lot of a love and respect for.
My guest is Lori Wolliver, co-author of World Travel and Irreverent Guide, a guide that she and Tony Bourdain were working on together before his death. Of course, he lived in New York most of his adult life, and you write that he made the distinction between dinosaurial New York, sort of the beloved institutions, and new places that could be instant classics. What are some of those spots, the beloved institutions and the instant classics?
Well, he really loved Keene's Steakhouse, which is, you know, among the two or three most sort of classic dinosaural, you know, still existing steakhouses in New York City. He really loved Russ and Daughters, you know, another absolute classic that's managed to sort of evolve and continue without changing its core business. But they're thriving, and he just loved what they did and how they really didn't change very much. The distinguished Wakamba Cocktail Lounge, right over by Port Authority. I mean, it's a real dive bar, and they haven't pivoted, you know, for the modern era. I mean, it is truly a dive bar. Gray's Papaya, just the perfect, as far as he was concerned, just the perfect meal. A couple of hot dogs, maybe sauerkraut and mustard, and a papaya drink. It's just everything that you need. He loved Le Veau d'Or, the classic French restaurant, which actually is in the process of being updated and renovated. But he visited in the sort of pre-renovation era when it was just these very, very old dishes, you know, frog's legs, snails and tripe, things that he learned as a student at the Culinary Institute. Barney Greengrass, you know, again, a classic New York institution that really did not change to suit the times and is all the better for it. That definitely is how his sensibilities skewed. I mean, he loved new places as well, but he had a real reverence for places that sort of stood the test of time.
We've talked about all these places close to home. Just based on your experiences traveling with Tony and writing with him, of all the far-flung places in this book, could you name one or two that you know he really felt especially strong about?
Well, he made no secret of his love of Vietnam as a place that really just fundamentally changed him in midlife. You know, he went from being a career journeyman cook and chef to being a celebrated best-selling author, and then catapulted into television and was a little bit unsure about what that was going to mean for his life and whether or not it would stick. And he has said many times and places that as soon as he got to Vietnam, he understood that his life was never going to be the same, that it was so overwhelming to his senses and so exciting. And, you know, it was a place that he had done a lot of reading and research about. He's very interested in the U.S. involvement in Southeast Asia and a big fan of Graham Greene. So then to arrive in Vietnam and to realize how much of the world he had yet to see and, you know, who knew how much time he had, Vietnam really represents all of that, the change in his life and his pivot to a storyteller who shared so much of his gift with the world. So I'd say Vietnam for sure. And he really loved London. I mean, he would go, even if he wasn't working, it was a place that he loved to go to see friends. He loved the old school dining institutions and the funny rituals. He loved the cabs. he loved any place outside the U.S. where they have such a strong literary tradition. And the same for Ireland. I mean, he just loved the love of language and the use of language and the use of humor that he really, even though he wasn't, he didn't have any Irish or English heritage, it was a place that he just felt at home in a strange way.
My guest is Lori Wolliver, co-author of World Travel and Irreverent Guide, a project she was working on with her colleague Tony Bourdain before he passed away, and she's seen it through. You know, you write about the Bourdain effect on restaurants that were highlighted on the television shows, No Reservations, Layover, Parts Unknown, and businesses would suddenly get this influx of Bourdain-inspired mm-hmm. pilgrims. How was mm-hmm. this something Tony thought about?
I think he felt a big responsibility to show a place exactly as it was. And also he and his producers were tried to be very clear with the people that agreed to let them come in and shoot that this could happen, you know, that they could become overrun with new visitors, that they could, that it could just change the nature of their business. Ultimately it was a decision that each business had to make for themselves whether or not to invite this kind of scrutiny and this kind of spotlight into their businesses. In some cases, it made things a lot better. It allowed places to stay open that might have been in danger of closing. And in some cases, you know, it changed things maybe not for the better. You know, the regulars suddenly felt they couldn't get a table when they came mm-hmm. in. So I think, as with everything that he did on camera, there was a real sense of responsibility to the people that were impacted. And he would often say, you know, we come in, we make our show, we decide what we want to tell you, and then we leave. But there are always people left behind that are impacted. Some people take risks by appearing on camera with us at all, depending on the political state of their countries. And in some cases, it has an impact on their businesses that it's not predictable and not controllable. So I think he respected everyone's decision to participate or to not, but he was very, very aware of the kind of impact that he had just by virtue of his outsized celebrity.
How do you hope people use this book, especially now traveling in a world changed by the pandemic?
Mm-hmm. I think that this book can be used in a number of ways. I think there are certainly people who are getting ready to travel again, starting to make plans, starting to dare to dream about travel. And I think this book can be a great sort of jumping off point. Look through and decide where you want to go. Or if you've decided where you want to go, look and see, you know, what Tony loved and really recommends in a place as a way to start to build your itinerary. I think also people who just miss Tony and his voice, when he was such a great writer and such a natural speaker, and oftentimes his writing and speaking voice are almost identical. So there's so much of Tony's wonderful voice and his writing in this book. So I think for people who just want to experience more of that, that's in here for you. And then people who aren't going to be traveling anytime soon, can't travel or just don't feel comfortable traveling yet, this is a way to kind of learn about and experience those places all over the world and in our own country without having to sort of take the risks or, you know, incur the expense of traveling. There's just so much to be learned through, even things as mundane as what is the airport called and where is it located and what kind of public transportation is in a place, you know, and then, you know, what do people eat there and why? So it can be, if not all things to all people, then many things to many people.
Was the word irreverent always in the title?
That was not something that Tony came up with before he died, but it was early on in the process of talking with my publisher and editor. It was, it was in the running. And I think it is kind of the perfect word to describe Tony. I mean, I think he always approached people and places with respect, but also with an irreverence.
The name of the book is World Travel, An Irreverent Guide, written by Anthony Bourdain and Lori Wolliver. Lori, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And that is all of it for this hour. I'm Allison Stewart. I'll meet you after the news.